Welcome back to the program. Maybe it's the fact that we keep trying to move to a post-racial America, that we've re-elected a black president. Maybe it's the movie Lincoln or Django, or that we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. But the subject of slavery, of freedom, and the personal cost of moving from one to the other is suddenly very much a part of the public meme. Adding to this is a sweeping new historical novel from the celebrated author of The Girl with the Pearl Earring, Tracy Chevalier. She moves from European to American history, to the 1850s, Quakers, and the Underground Railroad helping slaves escape to freedom. Tracy Chevalier is the New York Times best-selling author of 6 previous novels. Girl with a Pearl Earring has been translated into 39 languages and made into an Oscar-nominated film. It is my pleasure to welcome Tracy Chevalier back to this program to talk about her new novel, The Last Runaway. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit about this period, 1850, Ohio, the abolitionist movement. What was it about this particular time and place that captured your interest, that wanted you to move from the European history you've written so much about to American history?
Well, you know, I had the idea for the book originally from visiting Oberlin, Ohio, which is where I went to college. And a few years ago, I went back there, and as I happened to be there when Toni Morrison, the novelist, was unveiling a bench as part of this project she's initiated called A Bench by the Road. She gave an interview a long time ago saying, you know, there are no monuments to slavery or to African American history. There are no sculptures, no monuments, not even a bench by the road. And somebody took up that phrase, and they've started putting benches at places of historical significance for African Americans. So she was unveiling that a bench in Oberlin, Ohio, which is most people know it as a very, you know, quite a radical college and town. It was when the college opened in 1834, it admitted both women and African Americans as its students. And it was one of the first in the country to do so. And so it's always been a radical place, and it was a major stop on the Underground Railroad. It's not far from Lake Erie, so it was one of the stops where runaway slaves would get to there, and they didn't have far to go before they'd go on a boat to Canada. So it was very well known for that. And I, when I was watching Toni Morrison, you know, pull the sheet off of this bench and sit on it, I just thought, this is an amazing place and an amazing story to be told. And I knew a little bit about the Underground Railroad. We all do. You know, you learn about it in school. You learn about Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass. But I didn't really know that much. And then a few days later, I went to a Quaker meeting, which I grew up going to Quaker camp, although I'm not a Quaker myself. I like to go because you sit for an hour in silence, and I really like silence. So I put the two together, and I thought, oh, a lot of Quakers worked on the Underground Railroad. Wouldn't it be interesting to explore this and have a character who is very quiet herself, and see what happens to her? And then I thought, I don't want her, this is the first book I'm going to set in the States. I'm a little nervous about that, so maybe I should make my main character actually be English, because that will give me a foothold that I'm secure on. And I know it's kind of ironic that I am American myself, and yet I feel so nervous writing about the States. But, you know, a lot of great novels have been written about America, about the 19th century, about the Civil War. And that was one of the reasons I didn't want to write a Civil War book, because there's so many of them already. But I thought that run-up to the Civil War, that run-up to this very complicated part of American history that most of us don't really understand, and the Civil War, you know, is fought for a lot of reasons, not necessarily primarily to end slavery. That came about later. And it's complicated. And I thought I'd like to try to pick it apart a little bit, and maybe by using the Underground Railroad I can do that. And it's a kind of mythology. You know, it's been mythologized, and I want to see if I can find a reality under the myth.
And in many ways, the fact that Honor Bright, your central character, is British and comes to this country with a very different sensibility, gives you a point of view on the things that are happening here that makes it very different. In many ways, we see more profoundly that we are two countries separated by a common language, as some have said.
We sure are. And I certainly found that when I first moved to England in 1984, right after I went to Oberlin. And I've been here ever since. And it took me several years, really, to grow comfortable here and understand that it is a profoundly different culture. And in some ways, this is a book that allowed me to explore some of those feelings I had as a foreigner, as an outsider, always looking in, which I still am, even though I've been here a long time. You can hear from my accent, I still sound American. I still get people who meet me and say, oh, are you here on holiday? Or when are you going back? So I suppose The Last Runaway also allowed me, by having Honor be English, it allowed me to explore the differences between English and American. And it was also, I mean, it's in a way, I suppose it's the oldest writer's trick is to have the main character be someone who doesn't know something. So they go to a new place and they are discovering it and uncovering it for the reader. We see America through her eyes, and because we're seeing it through her eyes, we see it afresh. And so that made it in some ways easier to write.
And in doing that, it brings out the issue not just of race, which we'll talk some more about, but you get a sense of the class issues that were paramount even then.
Yes, there were class issues, although I think, you know, as is so often the case said about the States versus England, England is riddled with class, and America was founded on the idea of everyone starting out with nothing, and so you can only build up to whatever you want, and that the whole idea of the American dream. And so class, I think that Honor comes up against that, and she finds herself, she's rather at sea with how she should be with people, because it's very hard to tell what class they're from, and that throws her, I think, a little bit.
Right.
But that's a good thing, I think. It allows for a real shake-up of people, the types of people who interact in the book, those class divides just aren't there. If anything, the divisions are more along religion and also racial lines.
With respect to the Quakers, in many ways the Quaker relationship with slavery was one that was very complicated. Even though that the Quakers were at the forefront of the abolitionist movement, there were Quakers that kept slaves.
Yeah, and that was something I didn't know until I started doing research. And, I'd always thought of Quakers, I've always thought of the Quaker movement very fondly, and I think they're incredibly principled people and very concerned for social justice, and still are. And they were for sure part of at the very forefront of abolitionism. But what I found out really surprised me, which was, as you said, some of the early Quakers in the 18th century did keep slaves. And it was only, I think, in 1776 that there was a kind of proclamation from the movement that said, you know, mustn't keep slaves anymore, because this goes against our idea, which is that all people are equal. All people have a bit of God in them, and that means everyone is equal and should be treated equally and fairly. And I thought, well, if you have that sort of principle, surely you'd never keep slaves, but some did. And others were, I mean, I think the most surprising piece of information I discovered was this idea of the Negro pew. Now, apparently there were African-American Quakers in the 19th century, but they had a separate pew they were expected to sit on, and in the Philadelphia Meeting House. And I was really taken aback by that. I wouldn't have expected it of Quakers. So that made me think, you know, I started looking more closely into the Quaker response to slavery. And yes, there were lots of abolitionists, Quakers, but there were also Quakers who did not want to rock the boat. They may have been opposed to slavery, but they didn't want to help runaways, because they were afraid of, they were already seen as outsiders, and they didn't want to be seen even more opposed to the government. And there were people who said, you know, Quakers are also pacifists. And there were people who said, listen, you Quakers, you're willing to criticize us when there's peacetime, but at wartime you won't fight for us. So, you know, they didn't, and a lot of Quakers didn't want to be seen as such outsiders, so they didn't want to have anything to do with the Underground Railroad. And I thought actually all of that was in some ways a lot more interesting than just the straightforward Quakers, all Quakers are good and help. Because, you know, the world, I mean, pardon the pun, but the world is not black and white. The
right.
world is very gray. And I think most of the characters in this book end up being both a mix of good and bad, as we all are.
One of the other elements that you bring into this is this whole idea of quilting. Where did that come from?
You know, I always like to find some sort of hands-on activity for my characters. The last book I wrote, Remarkable Creatures, was about a woman who was a fossil hunter. And in order to write about her fossil hunting, I had to take it up myself. And when I wrote Girl with a Pearl Earring, I did a painting class. I always like to find something very tangible to do, and I started thinking about the women in this book, and what could they do? What would both English and American women do in their spare time? And I thought, well, quilting. There's a long tradition of it, and I thought, well, if I'm gonna write about it, and I don't want to go down the route of, you know, life is a patchwork quilt. I don't want that sort of metaphor. It's not cutesy, artsy, crafty quilting. This is like quilting for survival. The wonderful thing about quilts is that they are practical and made out of stuff that's around the house, but they're an outlet for creativity, so they can be very, very beautiful. And they encompass a whole range of historical layers, and I love that about it. And I also thought that quilts were a great way of pointing up the differences between English and American, because there are very different styles, or at least at that time there were. Now it's more of a mishmash, but there were different styles of, like, the English patchwork that Honor Bright does is this very kind of careful templates, geometrical patterns that are very carefully put together. And then she gets to America, and she finds in Ohio there's this taste for these quilts that are red and white and green, and they're applique, which is a lot faster to do. It's in some ways more practical, and she thinks it's a bit vulgar, but there are just ways that you can characterize American women versus English women using the quilts, and I found I had a lot of fun with it, and I learned how to quilt myself.
Talk a little bit about Honor getting drawn in to the Underground Railway and a reluctance at first to get involved.
You know, Honor is really at sea in Ohio at first. She goes over, I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but she goes over thinking she's going to have company, and then she doesn't. She's quite alone. She ends up with a family who have very definite ideas about how to live, and she has to, it's like the in, you know, having to live, fit in with your in-laws. And she doesn't really want to rock the boat, and yet she also sees the injustice of slavery. So it's a kind of understandable. You know, I think that we all would like to think if somebody in trouble ran into our yard, would we help them? And I think that is a we all like to think that immediately we would. But, you know, a lot of people don't, actually. A lot of people just want to keep themselves to themselves. And I think that's what Honor comes up against. She feels that with the family she's with, and she also feels it within herself. Does she really want to rock the boat for her principles? But then sometimes, what happens is that the specifics of, you know, principles get set aside when you see somebody who's actually got a bleeding foot or is incredibly hungry or needs help right away or has a baby with them, or so it's those sort of things that force her to actually act on each specific incident rather than thinking of it overall.
And of course, added to this is the resistance there is to doing anything to abolish slavery, the fact that there's pushback from outside, and she's coming to it as an immigrant as well.
Yes, and you know, it was a complicated issue, which I think that she, most people in England at that point were anti-slavery, and it was easy to be anti-slavery when you're not in a country that's founded on it. But she comes up, you know, and she immediately says that slavery is wrong, but then she comes up against these arguments, which you heard again and again in the 19th century, of if we abolish slavery, you know, if slavery isn't a great thing, but if we abolish it, the country will fall apart economically. So there were all these sort of attempts to find a way around that. And I think that she, it's incredibly complicated for her, and she doesn't realize it at first. She just thinks it's a simple thing, and then it turns out not to be simple at all.
It's interesting also that you chose to set this in Ohio, which is not a place that we ordinarily think of as a centerpiece of what was going on with respect to the abolition movement.
Well, you know, I think Ohio gets a really bad rap, and I'm going to defend Ohio. I find it a fascinating state because it doesn't really fit in anywhere. It's its own country, I think. It's not an East Coast state. You know, I've lived there. I know it's definitely not an East Coast state. It's not, but it's not really the Middle West. It's not the Middle West the way Iowa is the Midwest or Missouri. It's more. It still has a bit of the East Coast something or other about it, and yet what it really was a gateway. So people who were going west, settlers who were traveling west from the Atlantic coast, from the Northeast, which is where most of the population was, they had to go through Ohio. So Ohio was this gateway, and you had this huge movement of people going from east to west through it. And then you had actually a huge traffic of Underground Railroad runaways going through the state. I think there was more traffic there than any other state because it was between a southern state, Kentucky, which is a slave-owning state, and Canada on its northern border across the Lake Erie. So it actually had, I think it made perfect sense to set the book there because it had so much traffic. It was this very transient state that didn't quite have its own identity, and I think it's struggled with that ever since. But to me, it actually represents America in its, I don't know, in its